Alright, hello everybody and welcome to Lecture 43 in this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We are continuing with the story of the growth of the colonies, and in particular today we're going to be focused on that region of America that's called New England, and where Massachusetts is definitely the dominant state and was the dominant colony as well during the colonial period. And thus we are really especially concerned to pay attention to a people that have a really important role to play in American history, namely the Puritans, aka the Pilgrims. So it's important for us to, you know, be comfortable with this terminology, the naming convention that we're using for people, because there are a lot of kind of interconnected words here with regard to the Protestant Reformation and all of the different groups involved in it and so on and so forth. So we want to make sure as we move forward that we are using these terms properly in our minds. And so The root concept here, the most important one, is the term Puritan. So, what does that conjure in your minds? What is your operating definition in your mind of the term Puritan? I take it most of you do not have an operating definition. So that's the useful fact here that we need to reinforce. I know we didn't spend a lot of time on it yesterday, so that's fine. So, King, go ahead.
I would think, the way I think of is like very traditional, sort of, I don't want to use informal terms, but a sort of a traditional Christian person who... I cannot say anything else that
is. Okay, so traditional is kind of interesting. A related term would be fundamentalist. So a Puritan would definitely be somebody who is a fundamentalist. So in other words, somebody who believes in the fundamentals of a religion. But that's just. But there's something in the terminology that's revealing and can help you here. So let me go ahead and remind you of these terms here. So we have the term Puritan means English Calvinists. So Puritans were Calvinists. And they wanted a religion that was purer, and there's the key term, pure, right, or fundamental, than Anglicanism. So in their view, what they saw in England was a reformation for non-religious reasons. The word there is secular. They saw a revolt against the papacy for secular reasons. Reasons that belong to the king. Right? So to them that wasn't... And what occurred in the end, Anglicanism looked pretty much exactly like Catholicism, except the only difference was who was at the top of the hierarchy. In Catholic Christianity, you had the Pope. So people sometimes refer to that as the papal monarchy. Whereas in Anglican Christianity, you had the king. So it was the Church of England. It was the Church of the Kingdom of England. So the king was at the top. So to them, that was not a purified religion, right? And to them, Catholicism had become this great institution with the Pope at the top and this large, this huge institution is the right word, or edifice consisting of all of these or this organization, and it was no longer what they believed Christianity was supposed to be. And so they wanted something purer, something more basic, something more fundamental. So in that sense, we can use the term fundamentalism here. But so they wanted a purer form of religion. So that's where we get the word Puritan. And the associated term is pilgrim. In other words, the term pilgrimage means a journey for a religious reason. And so that's why we use that term in America, because they traveled to America for a religious purpose. Now, what is controversial is, what was that purpose? The purpose was religious, but what was it? And that purpose is characterized, typically, as being religious freedom. But that is misleading. So today, we're going to talk about, well, what does it mean to uphold religious freedom? And we know what it is because we have it in America today. And we'll have a useful comparison to make between the Puritans and America today. And that will lead us to an inevitable question, which is, well, if they didn't stand for religious freedom, then how did religious freedom arrive in America? Who did? How did it actually get here? That is a really important question. Because credit belongs where credit is due. And with regard to the concept of religious freedom, it is not the Puritans who deserve the credit. So we'll have to see, well, what did they stand for precisely? And we've got to use the proper terminology. We have to think this through clearly, because that's the difference between freedom and not, is the clarity of your thinking. The Greeks and the Romans were careful thinkers. That was the quality that they had, especially the Greeks. They were more philosophically minded, more careful thinkers, and they thought their way to a new solution rather than just accept a traditional answer. And we'll see that, well, the same thing comes around in American history, a gradual evolution of thinking towards a better way of life. But it first has to come with, well, a lot of examples of one way, doing things one way, and it doesn't work, and it's not as good as you'd like, and you have to learn from it. You have to learn from the good and from the bad, and then gradually get to the right answer. All right, so we'll look back on this. It's a really important episode here with the Puritans. So now, first I want to talk about, though, how did the Puritan colony of Massachusetts come to be so important? There's an interesting story, and it relates to religious freedom. So the Puritans, as I hope you guys already are comfortable with or will recall here, right? They came to Plymouth in 1620. All right, I guess I'm going to have a little whiteboard up here for you for a little while. So the Plymouth colony, Jamestown is 1607 and Plymouth is 1620. And but they had the very same struggles as the settlers at Jamestown. In a new place, not always friendly Indians. Sometimes they were, sometimes not. Not all the same tribes in the same area under the same leader and so on. And they had especially the problem of living in a harsh place. Winter in Massachusetts is definitely more difficult than winter in Virginia. Just simply learning how to hack their way, hack their life out of the wilderness was a great challenge. And so by 1630, there were still only 300 settlers in Massachusetts. So that's 10 years and a total population of 300. So if we're going to get, you can do some math on that if you want. If every 10 years you get 300, so every 100 years you're going to get 3,000, well, the population of Massachusetts is only going to be 12,000 people today. So evidently, we're not talking about, I think I did the math right there. So evidently, we're not talking about the success of the colony yet. So how was this colony going to succeed? Well, it certainly has a lot to do with the problem of religious, not the opposite of religious freedom, religious oppression, religious persecution. because it relates to what was going on back in Europe. So how did the colony of Massachusetts grow? Well, we've got to pull back here and go back and look at Europe. And so this map shows us the geography of the Reformation about in the year 1600. So what we have in light green is the Catholics, right? So we know Portugal and Spain, that is not going to change. Italy as well. And for the most part, the rest of continental Europe is still mostly Catholic as well. Except that we see that in Germany, in particular, and in Northern Europe, we see the growth of Lutheranism. So one of the interesting stories for the cultures of Scandinavia up here is that Lutheranism became absolutely dominant and rapidly dominant in Scandinavia. All around the Baltic region up in Scandinavia, Lutheranism took hold. Meanwhile, Calvinism had become kind of dominant in pockets of Europe. It had started in Switzerland. You see it there. And then it had spread out into France. And so it was kind of interspersed with Catholicism in France. And it had spread up into the Netherlands. And finally also across up to Scotland. So it was in different places in kind of small kingdoms here and there and a few parts in Eastern Europe as well. And then finally, right, the third of the major sects that had arisen in the Reformation was Anglicanism, and that, of course, is the Church of England, so it was in the region controlled by the King of England. A couple other smaller sects are indicated here, but not really important, and Islam is also indicated. Right? But really, for our purposes, the main thing to pay attention to is the four most important ones. So what was going on in Europe was, well, these new sects were becoming established, but the Pope and the Emperor were going to do their best to try to snuff this out. So we come to, where's the best place to annotate it? I'll just put it up here. Come to an event called the 30 Years' War. 1618 to 1648. All right, so the 30 Years' War was the decisive conflict, decisive religious war of Europe. It was the war in which the Pope and the Emperor went all in, tried at their absolute utmost to wipe out the competing sects. And it doesn't necessarily sound as impressive as the Hundred Years' War, it's not as long, but the truth of the matter is, of course, that you don't judge a war by how long it is necessarily, right? So, in particular, you know, we've got the worst war of all time would be the Second World War, and that only lasted 6 to 8 years. So the Hundred Years' War sounds really impressive, and the 30 Years' War doesn't sound quite as impressive, but it was actually much worse. The 30 Years' War was the worst European war until, I'm going to say, the Napoleonic Wars. So it was absolutely devastating. And so Catholicism was threatening to wipe out Calvinism. Threatening to wipe out any of these new changes, maybe all of them. And it was a very frightening time. And if you wanted to be a Calvinist in England, you had a double problem. The next part of your problem was that, well, cuius regio, eius religio. You can't be, because the King of England won't let you. And so we come to a point where the Puritans snuck off and made this little settlement over in America, But the ones that are back in England, of which there are many, many more, are starting to face a situation that's intolerable. They cannot practice Calvinism in England, and the rest of Europe is swamped by this terrible 30 years war. They're really legitimately afraid for the fate of Calvinism. So, the consequence of this is that we get an event called the Great Puritan Migration. Typically kind of this decade, 1630 to 1640. So what happened was they decided to leave. That's it. Europe is inhospitable, and we've got a chance here to go to a new place. And so the Puritans began to leave England in large numbers. And in particular, there was a man named John Winthrop. I'm just going to keep on annotating the page kind of informally like this. John Winthrop was the colonizer in this case, the organizer of this great effort. In 1630, he organized an effort of 1,000 colonists to come over. So we're talking about a really large expansion of colonists in Massachusetts. By 1640, there were over 30,000 colonists in Massachusetts. So by the end of the Great Puritan Migration, we're talking about a colony that has 30,000 people. It's evidently thriving here. We're talking about people of all different capacities, right? We're talking about carpenters and smiths and fishermen and farmers and every kind of laborer that you could possibly need in order to have a society where people are really able to produce all the things that they need and be independent. So the Great Puritan Migration was the ultimate success factor for the rise of Massachusetts as a colony. So absolutely true that Massachusetts came into being, in a sense, and New England came to be because of this exodus of Puritans from Europe, escaping religious persecution. But now we come to the more difficult question. Does that mean, as it is sometimes characterized as such, that the Puritans left Europe for their religious freedom? You're going to hear it kind of stated in that particular language when you encounter this kind of slant on the history. You'll hear people say that, you'll read this type of characterization. The Puritans left England for their religious freedom. Now, here's what you have to analyze when you hear that type of presentation. Is this phrase, their religious freedom. This is where you have to, your radar has to go up, and you have to be careful about, not that you never have to be careful, you always have to be intellectually active, but here's where you're going to encounter a slant that is basically false, and you have to be watchful for it. Does anybody detect it in the phrase, their religious freedom? Do you have some, perhaps, a sense that, oh, this by itself is an interesting phrase, and there's a clue there for us? Let's see here. Ben, go ahead.
They want to be free to practice their religion, but they don't want anyone else to have religious freedom.
Okay, you're on to the right track here, right? Okay, so what is religious freedom? What is religious freedom? So, back in Europe, we know what it's not. And so we have a very, very clear statement of it. Okay? Cuius regio, eius religio. It doesn't get any clearer than that. The ruler chooses the religion. So, in other words, the government has the power to dictate in matters of religion. That's on the one hand, that very clear extreme. On the other hand, the other very clear extreme is stated in the Bill of Rights by the Founding Fathers. And that extreme is, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So the other extreme is, as I have kind of shortened the formulation, no rulers in religion. That's religious freedom. No admixture, no compromises, no middle ground. Freedom means no rulers in religion. No one can use force in the realm of religion. That's what it means. No rulers, right? No use of force in religion. Religion is a personal, private, internal matter, a matter of belief. And therefore, out of the province of the government. The government is the agency of force in society. So these must be separated, is the premise of the Founding Fathers. Right? So another way to say what is religious freedom? It is separation of church and state. Another way to put it. That is probably the best phrase because that's the one that people recognize, right? I say no rulers in religion. That's a good kind of contrast to cuius regio. But the American phrase with regard to religious freedom is separation of church and state. So here's your litmus test of religious freedom. How will you know if somebody believes in religious freedom or not? It's whether or not they uphold the separation of church and state. Whether they uphold the premise that the government must be completely separated from religion. Because the government is what decides whether you're free or not. What kind of government you have, what kind of laws you are forced to adhere to, that's the test of whether or not you're free. And if there are laws pertaining to religion, well, now you have used force in the realm of belief. So that's the ultimate test. And there are components to this here, which are revealed in this story of the Puritans. And so let's look at those in turn. So the first story, now here's when the Puritans arrived in 1620, they did something very well known, very well documented, famous. They created a set of laws, not almost like a constitution for themselves. And let me go ahead and bring that up. Here's a little painting of the Puritans famously signing this charter amongst themselves, known as the Mayflower Compact. Go ahead and type that up on your screen when my annotations work. Mayflower Compact, 1620. So by the Mayflower Compact, all of the men of the community agreed to form a government and to adhere to its laws. Now, which has an element to it, which is kind of interesting. What does it feel like to you when you hear that people, where all of the people are signing and agreeing to a set of laws or to a way of organizing the government? What concepts have we encountered so far that kind of feel pretty compatible with this here? What does that feel like where everybody is assenting to the government? It's not being imposed on them from without, right, Juliet?
The Declaration of Independence.
okay, as an example, it feels like people adopting something of their own free will, right? Okay. So, yeah, there's a similarity to that. But what I'm asking is not a kind of concrete parallel. I'm talking about what is it? What kind of government does it sound like? What would we call this when people are consenting to a new set of laws? Keen?
We might be working our way towards democracy.
It's more in the realm of, more similar to democracy, right? Where people vote, where people in this case consent and they put their name on the dotted line and say, I agree to this and I will be a party to these laws. Now, of course, I like Juliet's comment that it kind of reminds her of the Declaration of Independence, because there we've got people signing on the dotted line too, right? So, well, which is it then? Maybe, is it more maybe like a republic? Huh, that would be kind of an interesting, challenging question. Which one is it? Well, the fact that the people here are submitting to a set of laws doesn't necessarily make it any particular form of government. What's going to determine how we decide, how we figure out what kind of government that it is and what these people believe in? Alexander?
What the laws are.
The quality of the laws. What type of institution are they going to be submitting to? And as it turns out, the intention and in practice, the form of government was government by the religious leaders of the community. Who were the members of the community that were viewed as being rightfully in charge of everybody else, morally in charge of everybody else, were the religious leaders. All right, now we still, that by itself is not necessarily religious oppression and religious persecution. It's going to depend now on how those religious leaders, now that they are the regios, and everybody has agreed to let them be the regios, what kind of rules they are going to make. So this actually is a pretty good, also a great, really good litmus test of religious freedom. And that is, put somebody in a position of power, and then you will really know whether they believe in it or not. Because once they are the regios, you will see. Right? Just because somebody is escaping from religious persecution doesn't mean that they believe in freedom. They're escaping a negative. But what kind of positive do they stand for is the real question, and how can you know? Put them in a position of power and you'll find out. So the Mayflower Compact was, yeah, it was what we would call self-government. It was almost democratic in the sense that all of the men in the community signed the document. They voted unanimously to join themselves into a governed community and then to consent to the religious leaders being in charge. The question now is, how are those religious leaders going to define the laws of the community now that they have the power? Well, the first case, well, that I know of, at least the first famous case of the conduct of the Puritans with regard to religious freedom came when a neighboring settlement near Plymouth called Wollaston, where the people there were not Puritans. It's a very small community. It's called Wollaston. Pardon my... Now let me get my spelling right here. I think that's how you spell it. Where is my... Yeah, that's how it's spelled. Okay, Wollaston. And 1625... was, I think, the date of the establishment of Wollaston. Now, this picture is not necessarily from Wollaston. It's just a good photograph of the ceremony that the people of Wollaston celebrated, and which is quite common in northern European countries, spanning from Sweden to England and all of those countries. It's called a Maypole ceremony. It's a festival that goes way back to pre-Christian times. And probably has something to do with the arrival of spring. I think there are a lot of different interpretations, and there might be variations on what it stands for in different cultures. But it's a ceremony that's just, it would be called a pagan ceremony, right? A non-Christian ceremony celebrating the change of the seasons. And so the people of Wollaston wanted to enjoy this festival. And their neighbors, the pilgrims, well, of course, were affronted. They viewed this type of ceremony as, and we can't mince words here, they viewed it as evil. They viewed it as a complete and utter repudiation of the true word of God, and thus they viewed it as evil. So how are they going to act? Here, again, is the litmus test. Now, this is a very challenging thing. When you're faced with somebody who has a different belief than you, how are you going to treat them? It's a very difficult question, because history is nothing but full of violence in this regard. And one of the key ingredients that contributes to whether or not you're going to have a society of religious freedom is whether or not you have religious toleration. Whether or not you can observe your neighbor conducting his religious ceremony, and you are willing to tolerate that. Which means what? Not the same thing as freedom, but it's definitely an ingredient. In order to have religious freedom, you have to have religious toleration. Absolutely. So it's definitely one of the foundational elements of religious freedom. So what does it mean, religious toleration? Timothy?
Religious toleration, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, good. Religious toleration means that if you're living next to someone and they have a different religion than you, mm-hmm. You still believe in your religion, but you accept that they have a different belief.
Right, exactly. You have yours, they have theirs, and, well, basically, if they're not harming you, well, then that's it. You accept the fact that their belief is different and leave them be. That's to tolerate means that you don't have to like it. You don't have to agree with it. But since your rights are not being attacked, you don't do anything about it. You don't violate anybody else's rights either. You tolerate their belief alongside yours because, well, nobody's hurting anybody else by believing something different. Thomas Jefferson's quote is I think my favorite quote when it comes to religious toleration. So hold on a second here. I'm gonna pull it up because I think I'm just gonna do a search for it, and then I'll bring it back up. I just don't know if the quotes that come up are going to be the right ones. So, yeah, here's a really... We'll get to it right here. Wow. So... Okay, here we go. All right, so actually this is not a bad spot to go to. It's the website of Thomas Jefferson's home called Monticello, which should be a pilgrimage site for Americans. So let's go there. So, again, back to this. If you go to... Whoops! Where did it go? All right, let's go back there. So, here's just a spot about Thomas Jefferson's religious beliefs. Why is that going away? You see that? I can't understand why that's happening. I want to highlight this text, and it's weird. All right, so here we go. This is my favorite quote from Thomas Jefferson on religious toleration. Okay? So he says, "It does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." That's the ultimate test. If you understand that there's nothing about somebody else's state of mind that by itself that violates your rights. When you are seeking to have your freedom, when you're seeking to be protected in your rights, the test is force. Whether or not your pocket's being picked or your leg's being broken, as Thomas Jefferson would put it. That's the religious toleration angle. So my neighbor may say this or that, may believe this or that, but that does me no real injury. That's the point. And therefore, I tolerate the difference in belief. So that's the religious toleration test. Well, when the Wollaston colonists had their Maypole festival, how did the Puritans react? Well, they definitely were intolerant. And as soon as their numbers allowed, which was in 1630 when the Winthrop fleet arrived, the Puritans decided that they would use force to eject the colonists of Wollaston from the environment. So they attacked their neighboring colony, arrested their leaders, and put them on a deserted island. So they're not the actions of people who believe in religious freedom, right? They used force to arrest the leaders of the colony and exiled them to a deserted island. So that's the first significant story with regard to the conduct of the religious leaders of the colony. There are many of them in the story of the Puritans in Massachusetts. And the next one is the key, and is really the key to starting to understand where does religious freedom come from in America. It has to do with the arrival in the colonies of somebody who was on the surface perhaps a Puritan, but who definitely had his own individual interpretations of things, a man named Roger Williams. So he arrived in the colonies and started to preach. He got into arguments with the Puritan leaders of Massachusetts, namely John Winthrop. And it turns out that Williams held a lot of views that were contrary to those of the leaders of the colony. Well, cuius regio, whoever's in charge of the laws, can decide who is allowed to live in the colony and can expel anybody unwanted, which is precisely what they did. Roger Williams was exiled from Massachusetts. Now, they thought that he would go back to Europe, and they were hoping that he would go back to England, but instead, Roger Williams went to live with a Native American tribe called the Narragansetts. They must be somewhere on this page here. Not on this page. That's quite strange. If we go to Rhode Island, what else can we find about him? All right, so I don't know why they're not on this page, but I'll type it in the chat window for you guys. The Narragansett tribe was a tribe neighboring on the settlements of the Puritans, and not surprisingly, not terribly thrilled with the conduct of the Puritans, but Roger Williams had personally held a true belief in religious freedom. So he went to them and negotiated the creation of a new settlement of Providence, which became the colony of Rhode Island in 1636. So there it is up there. And the purpose of it was to create a community of religious freedom. So here we really do have, we have somebody who is escaping the persecution of the Pilgrims, the persecution of the Puritans, and creating a nearby colony, Rhode Island, in order to actually spread religious freedom. So by 1636, we have Rhode Island joining other colonies that are slowly growing into, well, a collection of them. If we just look at this chart briefly, we see that, in fact, Rhode Island was the sixth of the colonies established out of the first 13. So by that point, there was not only Virginia and Massachusetts, but then New Hampshire, Maryland, and Connecticut as well. So it was the sixth one. And by this point, we're starting to get quite a religious variety. We're starting to get quite a few colonies that are Anglican, one colony that is Puritan, one colony that is explicitly dedicated to religious freedom. Now we're starting to get, this is starting to get, you know, the ingredients here for the possibility of religious freedom. But on the other hand, if this was Europe, what would we expect to have happen? Right? And we've got one colony believing one thing, one colony believing another thing. Who cares if they're Englishmen? If this is Europe, at some point, these colonies are going to go to war with each other. But fortunately, we'll see that that doesn't occur. They have other priorities. They're not numerous enough to have that argument. And in the end, well, they come to see the value of religious freedom across the board. So we'll talk especially tomorrow about another colony as well, Maryland. I can't highlight it by itself here, but Maryland established in 1634. And then later on, Pennsylvania as well, established in 1682. Two other really important examples of colonies involving greater religious freedom. So this is starting slowly creeping in and becoming a part of American culture. But the credit goes to these later peoples, not to the Puritans. So anyway, we'll continue with this story. If we get a chance also, we'll talk about, but I don't know if we can fit it in, but we'll talk a little bit about the most egregious example of Puritan intolerance and religious oppression, which is the Salem witch trials, which you probably have heard of. I'll try to post some recommended readings on that, because there are some really good tellings of the story of the witch trials in America, which are I think the ultimate example of religious persecution by Puritans. So, but anyway, we're gradually moving away from a kind of European way of looking at religion, Cuius Radio, to an American way, which is no rulers. No rulers in religion. All right. That's all we have time for today. Pick things up tomorrow. Thanks, everybody. Bye for now.
Thank you very much. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Mr. Powell.